Thank you. Now, I'm not here to change anybody's lives. I don't have any axe to grind at all. I will tell you to begin with that I'm the only woman who's ever been asked to speak at Yale University Chapel. This is supposed to knock you right out of your chairs. But the reason why I was asked is the only interesting part of it. The chaplain at Yale had read my book, and he sent for the assistant chaplain and said, "Have you read this book?" And the assistant chaplain said, "Yes." Well, the chaplain said, "I think we ought to get this woman here." He said, "Presumably all the churches and chapels in the world were built as a witness to Almighty God. Yale's never had one." And he said, "We've had the best preachers and the best lecturers. We've never had a witness. Do you think we could get this woman here?" And the assistant chaplain said, "I think so. That's my mother." Okay. Yes. And you hear my pitch, you'll know that with all my names and with writing my book under a pseudonym, it's very difficult to tell who's related to whom in my family. I think of myself as a woman with a boss, a woman under orders, and I think this is what my boss wants me to do. 2,000 years ago, there was a gentleman by the name of Jesus Christ. He was crossing an inland lake with his pals. When he got to the other side of the lake, he went up a hill. At the top of the hill, a man filled with demons came out to meet him. Well, nowadays, we've all gotten so bright, we look down on quaint words like demons. We prefer psychiatric terms, compulsions, obsessions. Meow by demons. Because I know exactly what they are, and so do you. These inner things that seem to have a life of their own, that seem to propel us into doing what we really don't want to do and keep us from doing what we really do want to do. Well, of course, Jesus Christ healed this man of his demons, and of course he wanted to stay with Christ. Why not? But Christ said, "No, go and tell the people what the Lord has done for you." So it goes on to say that the man went and told the people, and the people were simply amazed. Well, I am amazed that the people are amazed. I do not for the life of me know what people are doing in churches if they are worshiping a dead God. A God who cannot perform a measly little old miracle. I never have to explain what a miracle is when I speak at AA. Because every chair is occupied by a miracle, and we all know it. So this is what I think are my orders too, that I'm supposed to go and tell the people what God has done for me. In order to do this, I'll have to tell you what he had to work with. He didn't have much. I also have to talk about money because I had a great deal of it. I don't know that the love of money is the root of all evil, but if it isn't, it's sure a close second. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with money of itself. Money's a commodity like bricks. You can build a shrine out of bricks, or you can slug somebody to death with them. It's a matter of what money does to people and what people do or do not do with it. Money is a very divisive thing. And anything that divides the children of God from the children of God is an evil. I was an only child born to very wealthy parents, brought up in probably the most famous hotel in the world, the Waldorf Astoria in New York City. And every breath I drew made me think I was set apart from other people. I was different. I had rights and privileges that other people didn't have. I had never seen a hungry person, let alone a starving one. I would see pictures of them, but pictures are not people. I never really saw a slum or a tenement, because up here in the north, we're very careful to keep sites that would be uncomfortable for the comfortable. It's a long, long way from the Waldorf Astoria to that cesspool Harlem. I would see pictures of these places, but I could only wonder what it would be like to live in such places. Well, the truth is they don't live there. They merely exist. My own little world revolved around me, and then I got out into the world, and the world did not revolve around me at all. If any of you are doing this to your children, you're doing them the greatest possible disservice. As you yourselves well know, this is not your children's world. This is not a white world or a black world or a brown world. This is God's world, and someday He's going to get it back. I couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old when I realized that my father had a brilliant mind and my mother had a beautiful face and I didn't have either one. Right there, the soil began to be tilled for what later on became total escapism. Nothing so strong as an inferiority complex. Anyway, the phrase hadn't been invented. Just an inner sense of missing the boat. I would go places with my mother, who was a great beauty. Whatever people were doing, they stopped doing just to look at her. Then they would look at me and do a double take and say about me, "Well, I'm sure she's nice and wholesome anyway." There is no woman who wants to be wholesome. Whether we're 7 or 70, we want to be killers. My parents' marriage was already on the rocks when I was very young. So my father decided his only child should not marry. Marriage was for fools. I was to get a collection of college degrees in this country, then go on to the Sorbonne in Paris and perhaps to Heidelberg in Germany. Then maybe I could be the first woman ambassador to Great Britain. Perhaps in my spare time some rainy Thursday I could find a cure for cancer. Well, when you realize that all this was over 60 years ago and neither one of these things has happened, you can just see how advanced my father was. I heard all this baloney and I knew perfectly well I would never do any of it. First, because I wasn't bright enough, and second, because I didn't want to. But this, too, contributed to my sense of not measuring up. When I was 9, I went to Europe to school. I was over there for almost 10 years, growing from little girlhood to young womanhood in foreign languages. No home, really no country. I then returned to the States and went to Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. As many of you know, Smith College is not coeducational. And so this was the first place I'd ever been that my father couldn't go with me. This was pretty heady business because he told me how often to breathe and how deeply, what to think, what to feel, what to say, whom to know, what to study. Here I was off without it. Because I wasn't supposed to marry, I'd never had a beau and I had no small talk. For the first time in my life, I saw girls batting their eyelashes at young men, telling the young men how wonderful they were, and the young men would just capsize. If I had known I had a soul, I'd have been charmed to have sold it for the ability to make some young man capsize. But Smith College is very strategically located. It's surrounded by men's colleges, and you can hardly miss, and I didn't. In my junior year, I met a young man who was ridiculous enough to ask me to marry him the first night we met. And because the room was rather shadowy, instead of saying yes, I said when. I thought, wait till he gets me out in the light and sees how wholesome I am. I hadn't the remotest idea there was supposed to be anything holy about marriage. There wouldn't have been anybody who could have told me. My parents couldn't have been more moral, more ethical, more responsible. But there was no God whatsoever. If there is no God the Father, then of course there is no God the Son. And then of course there's nobody to pray to. I had not even been taught the childish prayer, "Now I lay me down to sleep." I had never been in a church, except for what I considered social functions like weddings, quite often my own. and christenings. I was a godmother 5 times before I was a Christian. Just how careless can priests and preachers and parents be? When I found out what I'd promised, I almost went out and cut my throat. I had never seen a Bible. I'd seen the great Gutenberg Bible under glass in a museum in Europe. But I'd never seen a Bible, and I didn't know anybody who had one. And I'd never met anybody who called himself a Christian. Well, now that I am a Christian, I think I have every right to assume I must never have met a Christian. Because how anybody could know about this and not be busting with it, I don't know. Either this is it. Either this is the good news, or it's a lot of baloney, and let's stop all this pretending. I married this silly young man for the simplest of reasons. Because I wanted to get away from my father, and because I didn't think anybody else would ever ask me. Well, these aren't good reasons for matrimony. My marriage should have failed, and it did. Lasted a little bit less than 5 years, and I got a son out of it. Young man who graduated from one of our great preparatory schools, Andover, and from Amherst College, both in Massachusetts, and who some years back now graduated from 10 very long years on Skid Row. A drunken, panhandling bum, a thief, in and out of jails, once prison, in and out of psycho wards and straitjackets. There were years at a time when I didn't know whether Bill was dead or alive. He appeared at my house once on the Mojave Desert in Southern California, his wrists very deeply slashed, just beginning to heal over, standing in the only shirt and pair of pants he owned in the world, both of them stiff with his own blood. 2 days later, he disappeared again, and again it was several years before I knew whether he lived or died. Everywhere I've gone, and that's a lot of places, I've asked people to pray for my son, and they have. We don't know what prayer is, only that it is. When little man begins to think that he knows what prayer is, what these great mysteries are, who God is, well, of course, then God wouldn't be any wiser than we are, and therefore not worthy of worship. This great massed force has gone out from thousands and thousands of people in love and concern for a young man they would never see. Well, I can tell you what prayer did for one young man. A year ago, last March 19th, at midnight, Bill called me from his home in San Francisco to my home in Kerrville, Texas, where I now live because I needed to be nearer the center of the country. He said, "Gert, I want to tell you that I now believe that there is a God, and that he has a son, and that the son has kept me alive so that I might be of some use." He said, "I understand that in the book that was written about the son, he is supposed to have said, 'When ye have done it unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me.'" Well, said Bill, "I can't imagine anything much more least than what the American white has tried to make out of the American Negro. So I'm flying to Macomb, Mississippi to rebuild their burnt homes and churches." I said, "Praise be to God, Bill." It's the first time in over 20 years I'd ever known of Bill Parsons doing anything for anybody. You could send him a splendid gift which you knew he wanted very much, and he wouldn't even trouble to acknowledge it. And here he was getting on a plane, flying to a land strange to him to work for a people strange to him. He was down there for almost 9 weeks, living under the pressure of the hatred of the white and the suspicion of the Negro. He said there wasn't a day passed that some Negro did not say to him, "You mean you're not getting paid to be down here?" They simply could not picture a young white construction engineer flying from San Francisco, paying all his own expenses, to work for them, under them. He then returned to San Francisco, and by then his third throat cancer in 20 months was upon him. This time they had to remove his vocal cords. I was speaking in North Carolina, and I flew out to San Francisco to be with Bill, and I've never seen such guts. There wasn't even any impatience, let alone self-pity. His surgeon said to me, "Miss Vahana, I hope you know you have a very valiant son." I said, "Yes, I do know." He couldn't have gotten along better in all areas, physiologically, psychologically, spiritually. 2 days before he was to leave the hospital, I flew to Miami Beach, Florida, to speak to 8,000 teenage Lutheran kids. And while I was on the plane, Bill died. This was last August 24th. I had been in my hotel room about 15 minutes when the telephone rang. And after I hung up, I sat there, wondering whether I should fly to San Francisco out of respect for the dead, or whether I should stay and hope to be of some use to the living. So the next morning, I was on the platform of the Civic Auditorium in Miami Beach, telling 8,000 teenagers about Bill, and they all stood up and clapped. And I thought, wow, what a tribute for Bill. So much better than flying to San Francisco, because, of course, Bill wasn't in San Francisco at all. Bill was about his father's business. Finally unencumbered, free of guilt and fear and shame, he was about his father's business, and wherever he is now, quite able to speak with or without vocal cords, I'm sure. It was tough on those of us who loved Bill, but it seemed so gracious of our good God, as though he had said, "Come now, Bill. Your prognosis is very bad, and while most of your agony was self-induced, it was nevertheless agony. Come now, you've had enough." And how splendid that he had met the Father and had met the Son before he went wherever he is. Must have made it a lot simpler. At the failure of my first marriage, what had been until then just this uneasy sense of not measuring up, now became a cold, hard core of guilt, and I lived with it. I ate with it, sat with it, slept with it, walked with it. With all this money, it was silly to think of getting a job, and anyway, I didn't know how to do anything. So I looked around for somebody else to marry. Men are such suckers. The only requirement for husband number two was that he be as unlike husband number one as possible. Husband number one had been very dashing, therefore husband number two must be a nice, quiet harbor. Well, I got one, and I didn't know how quiet a harbor could be. It can be very quiet. Good, kind man, very rich. We were married for 14 years. When I came to write a book about all this, I couldn't think of anything he'd ever said. Now, that's pretty quiet, isn't it? So any of you who have read The Late Liz, what husband number two says is what I think he might have said. Out of this marriage, too, I got a son, a young man who is now an Episcopal clergyman. I suppose the extreme opposites in my sons more or less epitomize the extreme opposites in their mother. Because when I was a pagan, I was 100% pagan. Now that I'm a Christian, you better believe I'm 100% Christian. That's the way I like it. Like people who do things to the hilt. If you're going to sin, enjoy it. There is nothing worse than a sniveling sinner. You know, these people who do something awful Saturday night and then whimper about it all day Sunday. Well, I can't stand these people, and now I'm a Christian, I have to stand people. It's quite a handicap. This younger son of mine is someone who makes me understand quite a bit about what God means when he says, Blessed are the pure in heart. Because Bard's always been good. Not a goody good, God forbid. I just might have shot him. But good. He's never been a phony. He's never been small or mean or cheap or a show-off. To jump ahead a bit, he was in Yale University in the summer of my conversion. He'd gone to Europe, and when he came back, I met him at the airport and told him what had happened to me. And I said, you know, Bard, I've always wondered about you. You've always been so great, and you had such a lousy mother that I wondered who brought you up. Well, now I know it was God. So I think you ought to give to him all the love and trust you've always given to me. Bard said, well, that makes sense. And that's about all he ever did say about it. He did what a fine old New York preacher by the name of Emerson Fosdick calls crossing the stream at the narrowest part. He was really right there anyway. It was just a matter of acknowledgement. As though he had said to God, oh, so it was you after all. It was in this second marriage that I became an alcoholic. I had been a social drinker, no problem. Growing up in Europe, I'd had wine with my meals, as is the custom, no problem. During my first marriage, I'd been a social drinker, no problem. Suddenly, I crossed this indefinable line from social to compulsive drinking. I don't think that by and large we alcoholics know what this line is, when it comes, or why, and I don't think it makes any difference. But when I was writing my book, I was writing it for people like my former self, who didn't know there was any hope. And I had to be as scrupulously honest as it was possible for me to be. And I came to believe that it was probably when I realized that my second marriage, too, was a failure, that I couldn't face it. As I'd been growing up, I'd been a very law-abiding child, perhaps too much so. And now all my adult relationships were crumbling around me, and I didn't know why. There was just one thing I did know, and that was that it had to be me. It had to be me because I was the only constant factor. I was the only child my parents had. Here were two husbands, two sons, one woman. But I didn't know why. I looked around at my own social group. They didn't seem to have any more wisdom than I. My father was dead and anyway long since disgusted with me, and of course there wasn't any God. God was a swear word. Jesus Christ were two swear words, and that's all there was to that. Never entered my head to hunt up a minister someplace, to go to a church. It certainly would never have entered my head to call myself an atheist. In order to call oneself an atheist would take years and years of deep scholastic research before you would finally decide that you did not believe in someone whom millions and millions and millions of people have lived and died for. Oh no, that would never have entered my head. It just didn't enter my head. I had been born with everything that everybody thinks he wants. A great deal of money, social prestige, an IQ the same as Einstein's, all the opportunities that God or man could give a human being, and suddenly I had nothing. As you well know, you cannot go out and buy a pound of self-respect. You cannot go out and buy a yard of inner peace. The only human being that anybody ever needs to be with his whole life long is himself. And I could not bear me. In total confusion, bewilderment, because I did have everything, didn't I? In terrible guilt and shame and fear, without the slightest idea that I was becoming an alcoholic, I began to run. Within 2 years of the compulsive drinking, I began to take barbiturates with it, and of course this is real murder. If I had to choose, God forbid, between drunkenness and pill addiction, I would take drunkenness hands down because at least the drunk's going somewhere. He's going down, but he's going. There's action. Maybe you can get a hold of him and say, come on, Buster, let's try it this way. But the pill addict, made in the image and likeness of God, sits there a vegetable. And it's pretty tough to make something out of nothing. I do not understand the promiscuous, irresponsible writing of barbiturate prescription by an otherwise almost totally dedicated medical profession. Do they not know we're an addictive people? Well, everybody else knows it. We're addicted to chewing gum, Coca-Cola, coffee, food. Half of America's out of shape. With a house full of servants, I would push the bell behind my bed for my breakfast tray to be brought up around 11. Then I would take Benzedrine to get me up, liquor to keep me up, and finally sleeping pills to knock me out. Well, this makes a very short day. It'd be about 2 hours out of the 24 when I would come up out of the fuzz. Then, of course, self-pity sets in. You have to blame somebody, because if you blame yourself, then you have to do something about it. So I blamed my parents. I blamed my husbands. I blamed my sons. I blamed the world. If I'd known there was a God, I certainly would have blamed him. Sitting hour after hour with the tears running down my face, a sodden vegetable, poor Gert. Oh, poor, poor Gert. Poor Gert, who'd had everything, had nothing. 8 years after this, I left the father of this blessed young man, married another man for no reason but that somebody told me I couldn't get him. Well, we now have a woman who's using human souls for her own amusement. And blessedly, this is not acceptable to my new boss. So I hope you'll all be pretty pleased to know that husband number 3 and I really deserved each other. We really had each other coming. It lasted for 12 years and there was never a dull moment. Husband number 3 was on the wrong side of the tracks. He didn't know the rules with the very rich. Now, you know as well as I do, you're not supposed to call the bluff of the very rich. Because all of us are snobs in one area or another, the very rich very seldom get their bluffs called. When I'd yelled divorce with my other husbands, they said, "Oh, what'll we do without you?" I yelled it once too often with a man from the wrong side of the tracks, and he said, "Okay, get going." Well, of course, I couldn't take it. This was the first time on any depth level that anybody had ever called my bluff. Anyway, I was past 50, and I have news for you women. When a woman is past 50, the line to choose from thins out. So if you're thinking about leaving Joe, maybe you better take another look at Joe. The idea of publicly acknowledging failure for the third time in a divorce court was intolerable. So I began to think about death. Now, we alcoholics are great hams, and that's fine. I like hams. That's one of the reasons I like living in Texas. They're all hams, including the president. But of course, we do with it when we're drinking what we do with everything else. We run it into the ground. Just before I left California, I had a couple of drunken pals out there who quite regularly turned on the gas and would telephone me, and I would go and quite regularly turn it off. It was a kind of a lively dance we did. They never said to me, "You know, you're pretty great to come turning it off," and I never said, "Well, for crying out loud, when are you going to stop turning it on?" But I did used to wonder what, once in a while, what would happen if I had a flat tire. I decided to kill myself, and I didn't ham it up. I didn't write any notes. I didn't get out my best French chiffon negligee. There wasn't any afterworld. That was a lot of junk. Of course, death would be total oblivion, and I'd been seeking oblivion for many years, and I wanted out. I wanted out. I loathed my ugly self and the ugly world I'd made. So I took 45 grains of second all, cold sober on an empty stomach. Anywhere from 10 to 20 grains is a lethal dose. I don't mean to imply for a moment that God stopped the cosmic machinery so that Gert Bahana could come to Cleveland, but I do know that I should have died, and I hope it's obvious that I didn't. My youngest son had been overseas in World War II in the 1st Marine Division. This was practically his mother's homecoming present to him, that he should find her body. He had great experience with death and near death. Okinawa was very good for that. He knew exactly what to do. He let me lie there not knowing whether I'd gone or not. Called the doctor in the ambulance in the hospital. And 36 hours later, I woke up in a hospital room with a lot of tubes in it, all of them ending in me. Now, I am against suicide. I don't think you should all commit suicide. But if you really want to make it, I kind of hope you do, because there's nothing more embarrassing. When you come to and find you can't even die, you can't live, you can't die, and you can't pretend you didn't try to, because even the social columnists know you did. And here you are with your face hanging out, and every person in every situation you refuse to meet, there they are, all lined up, waiting for you. I was in the hospital for 4 days. The night I got home, there was a message saying my mother died in California. So, great big phony that I was, I rose out of my bed of self-inflicted pain to go out to California to inherit more money. Isn't that something? I look at that woman, and I can think of her as that woman. And I know quite a lot about what Christ means when he says we have to be born again. This is a room full of banquet hall, all filled full of born again. This is no big anatomical deal. I'm just not that woman at all. I can look at her with some wry amusement, some compassion, and a great deal of distaste. But I'm not that woman at all. There's a line in my book which I think is brilliant, and nobody else ever quotes it, so I have to. It was as though we were Siamese twins, one of whom must die that the other might live. That's about it. I was in California for several months while the estate was being settled. Then I returned to the Chicago area where I was living at that time. By now, my crippled mind and crippled heart had crippled my body. I was walking with a cane, dragging my right leg from psychosomatic arthritis. My spine was so packed with calcium deposit, the doctor said within 5 years I wouldn't be able to move my head. I had a blood count of 38, which is, of course, pernicious anemia. And I had a spastic colon, which is no more romantic than it sounds. A total mess, you might say, fore and aft. I went to a small, and you may be sure, very expensive sanitarium. At the end of 2 weeks, the doctor in charge of the other doctor's reports on me said, "Miss Mahana, you are a very sick woman, and there's nothing the matter with you." This gets a little tiresome. You can't even have a disease. The word psychosomatic had just come in, and I was pretty proud I knew when to use it. So I said, "You mean this is all psychosomatically induced?" And he said, "Yes." But he then said something that nobody could try to be cute about. He tapped his forehead and said, "But make no mistake, we're all agreed that mentally you are a borderline case. Nobody can be funny about her own impending insanity." He then handed me a piece of paper on which were written two names. He said, "These are two Chicago psychiatrists, and we advise that you see one of them at once." I then did a very strange thing. I stood up and said, I don't need a psychiatrist. What I need is God. I have no idea where this came from. I do know that it was the first time in my whole life I had ever used the word God except blasphemously, and that right often. Now that I'm a Christian, I know something else. I know somebody sowed a seed. More unlikely sorrow than I was, you can scarcely imagine. That has nothing to do with it. There's a fine short story in the New Testament about a sower who goes forth to sow. Who goes forth 12-stepping. It doesn't say anything about, it says a little about the soil on which the different seed lands, but it doesn't say whether it takes root or not. Whether the seed takes root or not is the soil's and God's business. The sower's business, the 12-stepper's business, is to sow. Oh, I've been glad I've done that in the 18 and a half years that I've been dry. Because a lot of people have said to me, oh, Gert, don't fuss about her. She's impossible. Oh, no, nobody's impossible, as you well know. Maybe you're not the proper pipeline to reach somebody. Maybe I'm not. In our arrogance, does that make the guy impossible? Oh, no. A couple of thousand years ago, on the town garbage dump outside Jerusalem, there were three crosses. The two outside crosses were occupied by thieves, and there was a man in the center. And one of the thieves was overheard to say to the man in the center, when you get wherever it is you're going, would you remember me? And the man in the center was overheard to say, today will you be with me where everything is perfect. That thief made it by the last words he ever uttered. It is never too late and nobody's impossible. A week or so after I left the sanitarium, I got in my Lincoln Continental convertible, went back to New York City, which had been my former home, and I was drunk for 6 weeks. I wept on everybody's shoulders, told them what heels my husband's were, what a stinking world it was, and how much better it might be if people would just let me run. Then preparatory to motoring back to the Midwest, I went to visit friends in New Canaan, Connecticut. I'd only been there an hour or so, and my hostess said to me, Gert, before you go back, there's a couple I'd like to have you meet. Well, as you know, when we drunks are working at it, we live in a very small, tight world, and we're really the only persons in our world. We already know too many people, so I said, why do you want me to meet them? She said, because their lives used to be rather like yours, and a few years back something happened to change their lives. I said, what happened? She said, they were converted. I said, converted to what? I had a convertible top on my car, that's all I knew about the word. She then got a little embarrassed and said they were converted to God. Then I was embarrassed. I thought this was very bad taste. First place, there wasn't any God. That was a lot of baloney. Second place, if there happened to be some kind of a floating overall planner, he had nothing to do with me, and anyway, he had no status. He wasn't in Dun and Bradstreet. He wasn't in the social register. I never met anybody who called himself a Christian. I thought this was pretty bad taste. But I thought about it for a day or so and decided I didn't have anything to lose. So I said I'd meet him. And I got as drunk as it's humanly possible to get to meet my first two Christians. Well, now that I, too, am a Christian, I know this is a slap at us Christians and not at us drunks. Jesus Christ spent most of his time with the bums. You know that, don't you? He made the flat statement that the reason he came here at all was to find that which was lost. Well, if those of us who call ourselves Christians are so far off his track that the people whom he came to find are so afraid of us they have to get drunk to meet us. Maybe it's long past time that the Christian asks himself just what he means when he calls himself a Christian. Oh, in the last 18 years in churches of all denominations, including my own, I've met quite a few of these people. I think it might be a very sound idea to get drunk before you met them. You better believe it. People with cold eyes and pinched mouths, people without love. Well, these are not Christians, these are pew sitters. And we better convert these birds or crowd them out. Every church has got them. It's a cement block right in the center of every church. And they sit there judging. They can quote the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. But they never happen to quote, "Judge not, lest ye be judged." Never heard one of them quote that. Now these are not Christians. If you don't like the way the church is going, and very often I don't like it either, come and help us clean it up. You wait and see what we've done to AA in 2,000 years. We'll have it all bitched up. We'll have a pope. As you well know, we've already got bleeding deacons who don't want AA to change one bit from what it was that first meeting between Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. Well, it has changed. It's grown. It's grown and progressed, praise be to God, with the times. It's grown and expanded and been open to learn. Thank God. We don't have to stay in the horse and buggy stage, you know, just because some of us once rode in a horse and buggy. Sad thing about these people who passed for Christians are that the people who don't know God look at those of us who call ourselves Christians, and by and large they're pretty right to say, if that's what it means to be a Christian, I don't see that they're any different from anybody else. A Christian not different from anybody else? A person who believes in God not different? That's impossible. That's absolutely impossible. People shouldn't look at us who call ourselves Christians. They should look at God, but they don't know God. I just returned a week ago from speaking in Japan and Okinawa. I spoke to AA in Okinawa, and I spoke to AA in Tokyo. And I got a great big medal, and on the back of it, this is what they say is engraved. They say that it's engraved in Japanese, "We love you, Gerd, thank you, and welcome." Now that's what they say it says. I've got to find a Japanese somewhere to translate this. But maybe it's better to just leave it this way. I want to tell you that the young flyers with whom I spent 10 days, they know exactly what they're doing. We may not here in the United States of America know what we're doing in Vietnam, but the flyers know. Such a bunch I've never seen in my life. Sober, wonderful-looking members of Alcoholics Anonymous flying back and forth, except that some of them don't fly back. They all sent their love to you and tell you that one of the reasons they're over there is because of the God they found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in Tokyo, I spoke to a group that was part Occidental, part Oriental, and you have never seen such love. You have never seen such openness. I spoke to church groups all over, couldn't touch the love that you find in Alcoholics Anonymous. But don't forget where we got this love. We got it from God. We didn't get it from man. So come and help us clean up the places that call themselves worshipers of His. When my first two Christians came, it seemed just like anybody else. They ate their dinner and I drank mine. For the first few minutes, I bombarded them with questions about God. Oh, so they'd met God, had they? Well, wasn't that nice? Oh, I couldn't have been cuter. Well, I now get this, too. People say to me they think it's so nice that I've found something now that I'm old and don't like knitting. The man stood for about a half an hour and finally said, "Gert, you do have a lot of problems. Why don't you turn them over to God? It stopped me cold. The only reason I know it stopped me was that He meant it. When people mean things, people know they mean them." Here sat this sophisticated New York businessman, a partner of Merrill Lynch and Company, who actually believed there was someone to whom I could turn over my problems. I looked at him, and finally I said, "You make it sound as though I had luggage that was too heavy for me to carry, and I needed a porter." He said, "That's about it." "Well, I hope you know how blessed I was." If he had reared back and said, "Well, no, we hardly want to confuse our Lord Jesus Christ with a porter." That awful stained glass voice. Or if he'd been one of these awful Bible quoters. Now, I quote the Bible all the time. What else? But I quote the words. These people who sidle up to you and say, "Leviticus 7, 1 through 9. I just can't stand these people. The arrogance of thinking that everybody's memorized the Bible. When we go to help people, for the love of God, let us find out their level of understanding and then stay on it. Let us not show off. Now, AA is just as guilty of this. I hear people talking to some poor guy hanging on the ropes about the fourth step, but the guy can't even count the four. Wherever man, wherever we get our dooks on something, we ruin it. For the love of God, let us not ruin this latest gift from God, Alcoholics Anonymous. This man let me have the Son of God a porter, because that was the only level on which I could imagine help coming to me, someone relieving me of actual physical burdens. I drove back to the Midwest. The phrase "went with me" didn't mean anything, but it stayed with me. "Why don't you turn your problems over to God?" I went in my house. There was a 6 weeks accumulation of mail. I found a letter from this. It's a short note, really, from this couple in Connecticut welcoming me home. This amazed me. Why'd they care? They'd only seen me once, and I'd been a drunken mess. Why'd they care? It couldn't have been my money, because they had as much. They went on to say that every morning at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, they were sitting down to pray for me. Well, this just rocked me. As far as I know, nobody had ever prayed for me, and God knows I never prayed for anyone. And I remember these people weren't all fuzzed up. They weren't Blue Bird for Happiness Mother's Day card people. They were real, and whomever they were praying to was real. They closed by saying under separate cover they would sending me a little booklet called Faith at Work. If I had time, then we said, look at it. Well, I had time. Found the little magazine, opened it up, and the first page was a one-page article entitled It's Never Too Late to Start Over by one Samuel M. Shoemaker, about whom Bill Wilson says he had more to do with the starting of Alcoholics Anonymous than any human being who ever walked this earth. I never heard of Sam Shoemaker, but then I never heard of any other minister either. I read the article, stood up, dropped the book, and did something I had never done. I went over to my bed and got down on my knees. And I said, if you're anywhere around, I wish you'd please help me because I sure need it. And in about 20 minutes, it was all over. There are no words, of course. There never are. There are no words for why a certain man loves a certain woman or vice versa. There are no words for the strange chemistry that is always in AA. You can go into Portland, Oregon, or Portland, Maine, and there it is. You can be introduced to someone, and the introduction says he's a member of your club. And you look at each other, and love passes between you. Oh, no man's a fool to try to put the deepest things into words. All I know is that this was more like a spiritual shower bath than anything. I felt cleansed. I felt welcomed. I'd never had a home, and I'd never made one. And I felt forgiven. And I knew exactly who this was. I, who had never known one thing about God in my entire life, knew exactly who this was. There was no presence there, no figure. No doves lighted on my shoulder. There was no soft music nor soft light. It's just that there was something there that had always been there. Only now I knew it. After a while I stood up and I said, thank you very much, sir. I don't know anything about this. I'm going to have to start from scratch, but I'll tell you one thing. I'll never take another drop of liquor again as long as I live, and I never have. And I get pretty tired of people saying to me, I wish I had your character, because I don't have any character. It just doesn't make sense to me that a woman of 53 should get down on her knees and 20 minutes later get up with character. Where'd have been all that time? Something had been added, all right. And we of the Western world call him God. And you better believe I started from scratch. Within minutes, I thought, what was that prayer I had to learn in Smith College? And I'd gotten as far as Our Father who art. And I thought, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Our Father, not mine, not theirs, ours. If this was true, and it was true, all right, this made me sister to every human being on the face of the earth. Black, brown, red, yellow, white. The works. Whether I liked it or whether they liked it had nothing remotely to do with it. Our Father, one Father, brother and sister. Then, for just a fleeting moment, I thought about my own sex, the women of the world. The things I'd always taken for granted they should do that I'd never once dreamt of doing. And I went to the telephone and called my bookman in Chicago. And I said, Mr. Chandler, I want two books. I want the Holy Bible and the Joy of Cooking. He said, my God, what's happened to you? And I said, my God has happened to me, and he has. I've really never known whether Mr. Chandler ever picked himself up off the floor or not. First thing, prayer. Second thing, Bible, Word of God. Third thing I wanted was a minister, man of God. And the fourth thing I wanted was a church, house of God. Now, I do not believe in any of these four things because anybody tells me I should, or because I took a course in them, or because I was brought up that way. I believe in these four things because they were my own automatic needs within 1 hour. I called a friend of mine. I just thought I might have bumped into a minister someplace. And she kind of shocked me by saying, "Do you want to go get her or a man of God?" Well, of course, now I know what she meant. I've met quite a few Fuller Brush men with their collars turned the wrong way. I told her I wanted a man of God. Well, I got one. No great shakes as a preacher. Starts out preaching, ends up smiling at the Holy Spirit, turns back, dumbfounded to find us still sitting there. But you can warm your hands at the love that pours out of it. Tough love. Because all love is tough. The archetype of all love, even for atheists, the archetype of all love is a man hanging on a cross with nails in. Love is tough, or it isn't love. Love can hurt that it may heal. The other is sentimentality, self-indulgence. Love is tough. My God lives where I live. He doesn't live on cloud nine if I'm 11 to 12 on Sunday. A God who doesn't live where I live is of no use to me. He lives there where I live with tough love. This man just happened to be Episcopal. I couldn't have cared less, and I couldn't care less now. If God is the tent pole of all denominations, we're all equally good. If he isn't, none of us is any good, and let's forget it. The thing that mattered was the love. I told him what had happened to me that morning, and he just beamed, and he said, "Oh, yes, wait till you get your Bible, you'll meet Paul." Same thing happened to Paul on the road to Damascus. He made Damascus sound like the next bus stop. So real, so here and now, which of course it is, or it's a lot of baloney. Unless Jesus Christ is as living today as he was when he walked the earth in person, well then obviously the Jews were right. This was not the Messiah. We can't have it both ways. Either he lives, or the Jewish people are right, and we picked the wrong guy. I said to this man, "Can I come to your church?" He said, "Yes, it isn't much of a church, and there aren't many people in it." I said, "God will be there, won't he?" And he said, "Yes, he'll be there." So the first service I could go to, I was at, and I was the only person there except the priest. It's the first time I ever heard the words, "We have erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. We have offended against thy holy laws. We have left undone those things which we ought to have done, and we have done those things which we ought not to have done, and there is no help in us. But thou, O Lord." I thought, wow, those words were written for me, and I still think so. Was a kind of a scrimy little church. But behind the altar was a big stained glass window, so large as to be almost out of place. It was of a man kneeling in a garden. By now I had my Bible, and I'd read Matthew, and I'd found myself on every page but the Begat. Every phony, there I was. Every prideful, there I was. So I knew what this was in this garden. This was a young Jew. A young man by the name of Jesus Christ who died for an old woman by the name of Gert Bahana. And I still think so. I began now to pray my knees off that maybe I might be allowed to make something at least decent and friendly out of one marriage. Well, prayers are answered, you bet. But very often the answer is no. No. This thing had happened to me. It hadn't happened to Bill Behan. He thought I was nuts. So I got royally kicked out, and I landed on the Mojave Desert in Southern California. And there I found two more great things. I found that money belongs to God. And you'll agree that when God hits you in the pocketbook, you're hit. You bet. The more often I said, our Father, the closer I came to my brothers and sisters of all colors all over the world and in my own land. And the more I began to have some small inkling of the things I'd always had that they'd never even imagined. Oh, I thought about money for a long, long time. The Son of God needs lots and lots of money. He said, go into the whole world and tell them about me. Which is why I went to Okinawa and why I went to Tokyo, and it was very expensive. It was my father's brain that had made this money. And while science is greatly advanced, it's never yet brewed up a brain. So I finally decided that if everybody in the world, everybody, the blackest, dirtiest man you ever saw, the yellow babies who die nightly with bloated bellies on the sidewalks of Hong Kong, everybody, had a house and a car free and clear and $200 a month, everybody would have enough, and above all, nobody would have too much. If I believed this, of course I had to act on it, and so I did. There have been times when I wish I'd held out on God for inflation. My $200 a month is now $113, and you can't live on that. But that's the strangest thing. I don't have to. This lovely young man, Jesus Christ, made some very fancy promises. Do you know that when you take him up on them, he delivers? Well, he does. He says, your Father knows what you have need of. Well, he does. Everything I have is a gift. My suit, my blouse, the cross around my neck, my shoes, my purse, and whatever's in it. He used to think I gave this money for other people. I didn't give it for other people at all. I gave it for Gert Behanel. It's a cinch to give money when you have it. Of course, all you do is write a check. But it's a very special, tough art to learn how to accept. And if we can't learn to accept from one another, I don't know how we hope to learn to accept from God. We Americans are particularly lousy at this. We strut up and down on the richest God-given land on earth, using the free air to say we're not indebted to anybody. Why don't we hold our breath then? Why don't we just breathe 20 hours and hold it for 4? That'll show us. In most other so-called Christian countries, when friends separate, they consign one another to the care of God. In Spain, they say adios. In France, they say adieu. In Germany, they say Gott grüß. And we say, well, pal, take care of yourself. And do you know we're not doing so well? The United States of America never had it so good. We never had so much money and so much higher academic learning. And by the same token, never have the statistics on escapism been so astronomical. The increase in alcoholism, pill addiction, drug addiction, suicides, insanity, divorces, delinquent kids, and crime on high levels. So if we've got it so good and we can take such good care of ourselves, why don't we? Why are we running so fast from ourselves? Oh, I've gotten just shameless about money. I think it all belongs to God. I go around and say to people, come on, give me some of God's money. They're so amazed, they say, how much you want? By the time they've come to, I've gone with the money and given it to somebody. The other thing I found was Alcoholics Anonymous. Because every Everybody everywhere is searching for something to live by down where we live, gut level. In California, people began to come and see me. Some of them had liquor problems, some didn't. But the only thing I had to offer anybody was God, and I was busting with it. And still I am. But if God didn't mean anything to them, and they had a liquor problem, I'd say, go to AA. I hear it's just the greatest. I'd read Jack Alexander's article. I just thought it was wonderful. But I didn't go with him. There was one particular woman who came to see me in January of 1953. No, January of 1952. I was then writing my book, The Late Liz. She was sober until I left in May to go to New York and Connecticut to be near my publisher and agent. She was sober till then, and I said to her, Lil, go to AA. It's just the greatest, I'm sure. But I didn't go with her. So I called her up to wish her Merry Christmas, and she was drunk. Well, on $200 a month, which is what I had then, a call from Connecticut, the California is pretty darn safe. And she was drunk, and they broke my heart. And I began to think about this, and I thought, these people who come to you trust you, or they wouldn't have come. There's some kind of trust. When you advise them going to AA, but you don't go with them, you break the chain. So the end of January 1953, I went back to the desert in California, and I went to a longtime member of AA, friend of mine, and I said, Henry, how do you join AA? Well, he said, it's a pretty big deal. You walk in and sit down. Well, I walked in and I sat down. And I picked up the big book, and I read the first part of chapter 5 and how it works. And the tears ran down my face. I will tell you why this works. It works because it is the truth. A great many things are true, but very few things are the truth. In those 12 steps, I could not believe my eyes were almost exactly what I had been doing for 5 1/2 lonely years with my God. Very often they were in the same words and even occasionally in the same order. This is the truth. Whether you're working it alone in your bedroom or you're working it at a convention in Cleveland, Ohio, it works because it is the truth. Maybe this is pride, I don't know. But I don't think so. Sometimes I wonder if those of us who got our sobriety before we came to AA, don't get a perspective on it that is different. This is the greatest thing in the world today. It is the greatest thing. It is the greatest truth that God has given to the 20th century. It's just an old truth brought to life for the neediest, as he always does. Where the need is greatest, his love is greatest. Lest you think that I might not be a member of this austere group. When I first read the 20 questions, I said yes to 19. The only reason I didn't say yes to 20 was I never had a job to lose. So don't you worry about me not being an alcoholic. I was drunk for 30 years, and I've been dry for 18 and a half. This July will be 19 years. It insults me when some of my Al-Anon friends say that I've been sober so long I should be a member of Al-Anon, not AA. Al-Anon's the greatest, but I am a dry drunk. I am an alcoholic. I used to be a member of the Junior League. Now I'm a member of AA. I think it's too bad, though, that we're so afraid of the New Testament. This is going to kill the bleeding deacons. It's too bad that we're so afraid of it because we find ourselves on every page. Who do you think it was who was lost and is now found? We or they? Who do you think was blind and now sees? We. Who do you think was deaf and now hears? We. Who do you think was dead and now lives? We. Who do you think it was lying in that gutter that the Samaritan went across the street to get? That was us drunks, and the Samaritan was God operating in Alcoholics Anonymous. Who do you think the prodigal son was? Us drunks. And the father who ran to meet him was the higher power operating in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're on every page. We're the ones he came here for. I think that Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, I think of them as apostles for the 20th century. God couldn't be so mean as to shut it all off and not have any prophets or prophecies or apostles in 2,000 years. Baloney. These two men were sobered up by God to give us something from God by which we could live. Or we're pushovers for him once we let ourselves be, because we have the prime prerequisite. It's no job for us to say, Lord, I'm nothing. We always knew it. That's why we were running. I am past 72 and I have speaking dates to August of 67. Sometimes I think God's giving one old woman quite a pushing around. Sometimes I get tired and sometimes I get bored, and I'll say to him, would you let me off the hook for the weekend, maybe? And he says, no, keep going. You got on this pretty late. So we keep going, and of course I wouldn't have it otherwise. Imagine my being of any use. All my life I've used life and used people. Maybe now I am of a little use. All my life I've contributed to life's problems. Maybe now in some small fashion I might be contributing a little bit to the solution of some of life's problems. Well, that's quite a switch. And now in closing, since I have graduated from the sins of the flesh to the nasty little Christian sins, I find them so much more difficult than the sins of the flesh. If you commit adultery, you're apt to know it. If you steal from somebody, you're apt to know it. If you fall down flat on your face drunk, you know it, or somebody's always charmed to tell you. But I've now graduated to little hair-splitting nasties that I never get anywhere in. Sins like Gert, are you by any chance getting proud of not being proud? You just try that some weekend. I found out a few years ago that I'm that most revolting of all things. I am a snob. I am a snob about snobs. I look down on people who look down on people. I look down on white people who look down on black people, but I also look down on light brown people who look down on black people. So I'm in quite a bind. So I have two questions that I ask myself over and over and over every day of my life, and neither question has anything to do with my sins, mine are a full-time job. The first question is, Gert, how you doing with Jesus Christ? How you doing with him, old gal? What's the score? The second question is this for God? Or is this for Gert? If it's for God, we try to do it. If it's for Gert, we try not to do it. If we don't know, and that's most of the time, we just do what we do know and wait. I will close now with the prayer I always close with, don't bow your heads. This is the prayer of a long dead slave. Oh Lord, I ain't what I want to be. Oh Lord, I ain't what I ought to be. Oh Lord, I ain't what I'm gonna be. But thanks, Lord, I ain't what I used to be. Amen. Bless you.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. Please check out our website at sobrietytalks.com. You can also contact us by sending an email to sobrietytalks@aol.com. Thank you.